Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri, in for Jane Lindholm, who's on maternity leave. The Winter Olympics in Russia generated a lot of political debate in the months leading up to the Games. Among the criticism of Russia is a law that targets and suppresses expressions of gay pride. That's the focus of a recent article by Dartmouth College professor Jeff Charlotte. His story, Inside the Iron Closet, What It's Like to Be Gay in Putin's Russia, appears in this month's GQ magazine. Vermont Edition managing producer Patty Daniels spoke with Charlotte as the games in Sochi, Russia, were getting started.
Jeff, the Russian Duma passed a law last June that has become the focal point for the legal status of gays in Russia. Explain what that law does.
It's Article 6.21, and it's popularly known as the gay propaganda law, or rather the anti-gay propaganda law, forbidding propaganda to minors in the service of any sort of deviant sexualities. It doesn't say homosexuality. That's what it's understood by everyone to be. To date, there's only been a handful of prosecutions, but the real effect of the law is to drive people back into the closet, or in many cases to drive them out of the country. There's been a sort of an exodus to make sort of show trials of queer people in Russia, LGBT people in Russia, to tell them that they are not welcome, and that worse than that, they are what the government is almost now calling the new enemies of the state.
And you profiled many people in your article who are trying to figure out how to live both in and out of the closet in Russia. Some of them you actually name. Some of them are anonymous. Some of them just go by first names in your article. But what is the range of opinion that they shared with you about how this law has impacted their lives?
You know, it was interesting. Sort of by day, I would go around and I would talk to activists and a whole range of activists. And they have sort of different political ideas, but we're all very uniform in saying that this is very big, very bad. It's getting much, much worse, just quicker than anybody could have imagined. And I would also talk to regular folks, people who weren't activists, people who were living hidden lives, closeted lives, suburban moms and dads. And they said the same thing. But at night, I would go out to the gay clubs that survived. There used to be a fairly thriving scene in Moscow and St. Petersburg. And there I would meet men especially who would say, oh, the law has no effect. I would meet men who would say the law is a good thing. Men who had been in the closet for so long and were so accustomed to it that they had come to believe in it. And then there was people, one man named Yuri, a middle-aged guy I met at a club called The Bunker, which is now essentially a place for men who live otherwise straight lives, married lives, and so on, to go and connect in the dark with one another, literally in the dark. But there's a small little bar, and I spoke to Yuri, and he said, no more pride parades. We can't ask for our rights anymore. This is Russia. He says, this is not Europe. This is Russia. He says, I will be beaten. You will be beaten. He gestures to another man. He will be beaten. We will be beaten. And we go to the police, and the police just smile.
And so was the sense you got one of fatalism?
Well, there's fatalism on the part of, people who have gotten used to the closet. But then there's these activists of astonishing courage. And there's a fatalism there, too. They know they'll be beaten. I mean, when this man says no more pride parades, a pride parade in Russia is not what we think of here. It can last maybe two, maybe 3 minutes. You go, you meet at a prearranged place, you unfurl your flag, and you hold it until someone beats you down, and then the police arrest you for being beaten. That was your crime, being beaten. And yet people go to these events. So that's not fatalism. It's a sort of a steely endurance. It's hard for us to quite imagine, but they're going to keep fighting.
You write a lot about physical violence in your article, and you interviewed several people who have been assaulted during gay pride parades, as you put it, or protests, or for simply attending social clubs or support groups. How prevalent is violence against gay people in Russia, or shaming of gay people in Russia?
If you're very, very closeted, you can't avoid it. I don't know how many dozens of people I spoke to there. It was a very small minority had not been beaten for their orientation at some point in their lives. If they were or had been out, because you have to remember, just a few years ago, things are just getting brighter and brighter every day for LGBT people in Russia. This is not some vestige of an old bigotry that rushes backward. This is a new thing. So people a few years ago, you know, they'd still struggled. They'd been fired from their jobs. Everyone had been subject to violence, and it was so ordinary that no one led with the story. And that was what was really interesting. If you or I had been beaten for going to a demonstration, we would probably think that was a very big deal. It would come up in passing. It would come up an hour into the conversation. Someone would make a gesture to a jaw that had been broken, a nose that had been smashed, as if this was something that just happened to people.
And you write that that kind of violence has really accelerated in recent years. And you also write that it's taken on a politically charged form. And I want to ask you, Jeff, to explain how you characterize the connection between President Vladimir Putin's government and also the Russian Orthodox Church in fomenting this new brand of homophobia.
You know, there's a lot of very sort of establishment figures who say, what do you mean connection between Putin's government and the church? They're one and the same. Patriarch Kirill, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, long thought to have been associated with the KGB in the Soviet days, as of course was Putin. You know, they're old colleagues. And Kirill now speaks of Putin as he calls Putin an act of God. The leadership of the church, and there's dissidents within the church, of course, but the leadership of the church has sort of seen its angle to power. You have to remember that Putin came to office in 2000. For a while, he seemed to be bringing prosperity. He was riding the wave of oil dollars. He left. There was term limits and became prime minister, did a stint as prime minister so that he could then come back and be president. Even when he was prime minister, he was running the country. And when he came back in 2012, that's when all this sort of emerged. And homophobia, which had been there like it is in any country, it became a political weapon. There's a big difference between just sort of a cultural bias and what we see now, where the state is actively campaigning against this, using homophobia to distract people from the fact that the oil money isn't flowing as smoothly as possible, to suggest that there's this enemy within. This is really important because I think we say, well, we have homophobia in America too, but we don't have it as a state policy. That's what's crucially different.
You mentioned Yelena Kostuchenko, who writes for Novaya Gazeta, and she put it to you that Putin needs internal enemies.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I heard this several times. I mean, this is always nationalist and demagogic politicians always look for internal enemies, right? But who should the internal enemy be? For much of Russian history, the internal enemy was easy. It was the Jews. Well, that's not kosher anymore after the Holocaust. And Putin makes a big show of his support for the few Jews that remain in Russia. At the beginning of his I think it's fair to call it a regime at this point, the beginning of his regime, it was the Chechens. And, you know, they fought really two wars in that region. And they don't want it to go down that road. For a while, it was the immigrants, and there were street gangs beating immigrants with the sort of tacit approval of the police. But the immigrants were very well organized. And so you can almost imagine, and Elena sort of says, you sort of imagine them sitting around saying, well, who is it going to be? And then, you know, someone saying, I've got it, the gays. They're everywhere, but you don't know who they are. They look like everybody else, but they're different. We can use them to frighten people all the time.
We've been talking about homophobia in the context of modern Russia, and of course, it's not unique to Russia. Jeff Charlotte, why don't you put it in context for other similar movements that we've seen in other countries around the world?
Yeah, and they're really coming to the fore right now. Just recently, India recriminalized homosexuality. Uganda, they've already passed the so-called Kill the Gays bill. It's been watered down. Instead of death penalty now, it's just life imprisonment. And I've reported on these issues firsthand from Uganda, from Kenya, Russia, and the United States. And what's interesting is in all these places, you hear the same language. I mean, literally, whole phrases lifted, so much so that in Russia, I would be speaking with Russian nationalists, very anti-American, didn't speak English, but then they'd pepper their Russian speech with phrases like family values, traditional values, in those terms. So what they're doing is they're sort of taking these ideas from the American culture wars, amplifying them, making them much stronger, and use them, tap into the native homophobia of their country and turn it into a new political formation. That's really what's most frightening. And I think that's why we have to pay attention to what's happening in Russia, Eastern Europe, Africa, India, really around the planet.
We started this conversation, Jeff Charlotte, by talking about the law that was passed in June about propaganda. But many of the people you interviewed are actually more concerned with a second law that they expect will be passed this year. That's a bill that would make it illegal for gay and lesbian couples to have children. The people you interviewed expressed real fear for what would happen to their families if this law is passed. Describe what they told you.
Well, the law was introduced in October, and it would allow the government to take away children from queer families. It already has that power, and in fact, the gay propaganda law is being used by some people to blackmail queer families. Give us payments or we're going to turn you in for propagandizing your own children by just letting them know you exist. But this law would be more formal. I mean, there's even a possibility that would create special branches of the police to look for these people. And the law was introduced in October and then kind of put to the side, but nobody, left, right, anywhere in the political spectrum, had any doubt that it was coming back after Sochi, that that was the step too far that Putin didn't want to take while the world was watching. Everyone believes it will come back, and the question is how it will be used. Most of these laws, you have to remember, are not used to be radically enforced. They're used to make people hide.
The discussion of Russian politics really has receded since the Olympic competition has begun. Can you say, on balance, whether the Olympics have changed the circumstances of gay people in Russia?
You know, I think they have in a kind of surprising way. And among these activists, they said, look, this is our window of opportunity. When the world is watching, this is our chance. We need to gain as much ground as we can because it's going to get worse after this. There was a sense of people positioning themselves, building as many allies as they could. And I think they did a pretty good job. While NBC hasn't done what I had hoped, there's been more media on this than I think anybody expected. But it shows how much ground LGBT, I don't want to say activists, LGBT people have made in Russia.
That's writer and journalist Jeff Charlotte. His article, Inside the Iron Closet, appears in this month's GQ magazine.